Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Midtown Group in Washington, D.C., and my sobriety date is May 20th, 1996. And it's an honor to be asked to speak, and it's really nice coming out here and meeting your group. I'm impressed, and it's so beautiful, a nice change from Rockville. And we had a really nice drive. We couldn't have asked for a more beautiful day, and we were telling some people before the meeting that we're telling ghost stories the whole way here for some reason. I don't know, city people, as soon as we get away from the city, we think everything is haunted, I guess. So we were all telling ghost stories, and it was nice, you know, just one of those good experiences, and it was reminiscent of our home group has, for years, had a tradition of renting beach houses down in Ocean City, Maryland, every summer, and started out with one house long before I got sober, and now we rent like 13 houses every summer, and they're 400 people, and everyone, every Friday after work, just jumps in the car, rides down to the beach, and stays for the weekend, and then drives back Sunday evening for our home group meeting, and so this drive is reminding me of all those beach drives, and so many wonderful experiences that I would not have anticipated having when I first got sober, and so I will tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I, from the very beginning of my life, had an attraction to things that were not real, to things that were fantasy-related. You know, I was obsessed with, like, Alice in Wonderland and these kinds of movies that just involved some kind of fantasy, some kind of escape from reality. And it's funny, I have a friend here who just got sober that was a friend from elementary school. We've known each other for 15 years or something, and I was talking to him today about the first time I got in any real trouble as a kid was in fourth grade. My next-door neighbor taught me how to make myself pass out. And I felt like I had uncovered a treasure that needed to be shared with the rest of the world. And because it was just great, you know, I fainted and I had this vision like I was on a roller coaster, and I woke up and I was like, wow, that was really cool. I want to do this all the time. And I also found that it was a coping mechanism. If I got upset, I would just make myself pass out, and then I felt better. And I remember I had a friend who was upset one time at my house. We were like 10 years old, and her parents said she needed to come home early, and she got really upset. And I said, well, why don't you just make yourself pass out? I'll teach you how. And she gave me a look like, no, that's okay. And, and you know, I think those kinds of things, I didn't think anything of it at the time, but now looking back, I can see that I never seemed to have a tendency to really deal with life or my feelings or take it as it comes. You know, I always was trying to either things needed to work out the way I intended for them to work out, or I was going to just seek some sort of oblivion from what was happening. And the very first time that I got drunk, I had little encounters with alcohol when I was younger, but the first time I really got drunk was at a friend's house, and her parents were out for the evening, and we were drinking vodka straight, and she went to the bathroom, and I thought, I better get more because I might want more, and she might question that. So I refilled my glass, and I drank like two glasses of vodka. Now, I had no idea at that time what was the normal amount or anything, so I ended up, I think, that night getting alcohol poisoning, and I had shadowy recollections of, you know, somersaulting down the stairs and going out in the snow, only partially clothed, and then my father picked me up, and I was violently sick for hours and hours. And I came home, and I got halfway up the stairs, and I had to turn back around and run to the bathroom and throw up. And when I finally got to my bed, I had never had any religious beliefs growing up, but I said that alcoholic prayer, which I never would have thought at the time, but I said, God, if you take this feeling away, I'll never do it again. I'll never do this again. I really felt so sick that I wanted to die. And clearly I had certainly no thought of that again any time, you know, and that was sort of what happened for me throughout. The Big Book talks about different types of drinkers, that sometimes there's sometimes we justify our drinking, and sometimes there's no thought at all. And I was always a no thought at all person. And later, in fact, I never really would question it myself, only other people would. And I would feel like I was misunderstood. So I went on, and I had fun for several years, you know. I experimented with some drugs, and I just had a great time, and things were fine. And then eventually I kind of discovered that I could drink alone. You know, why not drink alone? It's this great with people. And I started to keep a little stash in my room. I had a toy chest, actually, that was like a bench, and you opened up the seat, and I started storing everything I could collect, little glasses and bottles of alcohol, and I guess I was about 12 years old, and it just felt like my little secret that I could turn to it whenever I wanted for comfort, and it was nice, and I loved having that, like a safety net, and I loved the feeling of taking a drink and climbing into bed and just feeling that comfortable, numb feeling. I just really, really enjoyed that feeling, and so I kept pursuing it, and eventually I started to have some problems. I started to get in some trouble. I got caught with drug paraphernalia, and little things like this would happen. I got suspended from school, and I would get in trouble, and my parents started finding me stealing alcohol from their liquor cabinet, and so they started locking everything up, and then I broke into that, and I would just lie. I started lying at that point, too, and I don't remember really being a big liar as a kid, but when I was drinking, it was the one thing in my life that I would absolutely lie about 100%, and it didn't seem to me at the time that it was really obvious that I was lying, but it was obvious to everyone around me that I was lying, and I've seen that now since I've been sober. When I've worked with people, sometimes I'm naive, but sometimes it's so obvious to me that someone's lying to me and themselves, but that's just, I guess, the nature of this, and so I started to get in more and more trouble in those small ways, but it just felt like something I needed to get around, and eventually, at some point, I had my first encounter with outpatient rehab. My parents sent me to an outpatient program in a hospital, and there was no consideration of not drinking at that time. And I went, and they described the theories of alcoholism and everything, and we went to AA meetings for the first time, and I definitely didn't take it seriously. They told me to get a sponsor, and there was a woman with an Irish accent, so I asked her because I liked her accent, and I definitely never called her, and I just did whatever I had to do to try and pass the urine tests, and actually my drinking really took off at that time because I was taking urine tests, so I figured, well, I can drink more and cut out drugs entirely, and I always felt like I had a special relationship with alcohol anyway. Like, it gave me some absolute feeling of safety that nothing else did. With drugs, I didn't know what was necessarily going to happen. Sometimes it was bad. And with alcohol, I knew exactly what was going to happen, and it just made the world disappear for me. And I think that definitely normal people drink to relax, but I don't know that that happens on such a profound spiritual level for them. And so I got my way through that rehab, and even there I was lying to everyone, and they called me out on it, and I would just get violent and rebel, and I was, eventually my parents started taking me in for frequent breathalyzer tests, and I would fail them, and then I would scream at the nurses and insist that they were wrong, which is obviously ridiculous. I'm sure they deal with that all the time with alcoholics that are just belligerent and clearly lying but have no other way out. And so around that time, I found this boyfriend who was just as self-destructive as I was, and it seemed like we were the perfect match, and he was selling drugs to a friend of mine, and so that was a major benefit to me, and he just seemed dark and mysterious and very self-destructive. We attracted each other like a moth to a flame, and we really self-destructed a lot together, and he, during the time that we were dating, he eventually was homeless and dropped out of high school, and so he started sleeping in my closet at my parents' house when I was 14, and this was sort of the delusional alcoholic thing where he would come in to my room and get caught repeatedly and thrown out in the middle of the night, and we continued to do the same thing. And so my family, this is where I started doing real damage within my family, because my parents would find this guy in my room, you know, in the middle of the night. I'm 14 years old, and they'd have to throw him out, and then the neighbors would come up and, you know, ask for his belongings for him because he was too afraid to come back, and so they were really embarrassed in our neighborhood of all of this stuff, and at that time I started getting really, really depressed, and I didn't associate it at all with drinking, for sure. I just felt like I spent a lot of time thinking there's something fundamentally wrong with me. I don't know what it is, but I'm different from other people, and I feel like I'm separate from the world, and I felt very depressed, and my dad had a degree in psychology, so I would sit up and I would read his books and try and diagnose myself. And I would even fake different disorders, thinking if I could have this, then that would explain it. I had earlier on when I was more under control and getting into very little trouble, I had this one boyfriend that was totally normal and doing normal things at that age, playing sports and all of these things. And one night I tried faking multiple personalities with him because I felt like somehow that would make me intriguing to him. And he was not at all. He definitely faded out, and I couldn't understand why he had lost interest in me. But I felt I was looking for an answer, you know, and I was thinking that when we were talking about the ghost stories, that I think we're all really looking for an answer, and that we don't realize until we've been sober a while, usually, that what we're looking for is spiritual. So I was looking, and I was looking for an explanation for what was wrong with me, and I felt like if someone could just put me away somewhere, that would be great. Life would be easy. I'd be happy with that. I wasn't really interested in having a normal life, and that's one of the things that getting sober young was hard for me. Because I had never had a normal life and then destroyed it by drinking. I hadn't gotten there yet, so I had no aspirations. I had no career that I ruined. I had no family, all of that. And so it was difficult for me to see the consequences. They were all internal for me, basically. And so, anyway, during this phase with this boyfriend living in my closet, I had become suicidally depressed. And I would have these... everything was like a fantasy world to me, and he would always throw rocks at my window and climb up, and this seemed so very romantic to me, and I thought, well, if I commit suicide and he climbs up and finds me, I'm sure he'll kill himself too, and it'll be just like Romeo and Juliet, and I was just completely delusional, and what happened to me during that time is I started to hit a bottom. And around Christmas of that year, actually on Christmas of that year, I found out that I was pregnant. And I was 14, and I was at my family's Christmas dinner, and I just knew. And my cousins, who were, like, very normal and happy and healthy and married, not, you know, they weren't both cousins of one another, but announced that they were having a baby. And everyone was so happy. And it was one of those moments, we all have these moments of clarity. It was one of those moments for me where I thought, I'm never going to have this normal existence that these people seem to have. And I started to have all these dark secrets that I felt like I couldn't tell anyone. But then part of me thought, well, I will have a baby and I will just shape up and I'll be normal and we'll get married and it'll be like a normal life, which was crazy and delusional. And eventually everyone around me talked me out of that idea, and I ended up having an abortion when I was 3 days after my 15th birthday. And that was really like an emotional bottom for me. And in addition to that, I found that I wasn't able to not drink during that time. You know, I found myself still drinking in spite of that. And I didn't even think about that until after I got sober. There was no thought of it. You know, I decided, well, now I'll stop, and then I never thought about it again. So I started to really have so much remorse and shame inside that I just, I was sort of at that point about in the big book where they talk about just blotting out reality to the bitter end. I had no hope of, you know, getting better or turning myself around. I was just trying to cope with how I felt inside. And from there, I just continued on that same path. And I had some, I continued to make decisions that I did not feel good about. And they were usually when I was drunk. And I felt that I had to drink to feel okay. And it never made sense to me that alcohol was a problem, because it was the only thing that made me feel okay inside. To me, it seemed like society was the problem. My family was the problem. The police were the problem. And I would sit and try and think of, how can I find a way around all this? How can I, you know, figure out a way to live this life and not have it constantly interfered with? And there was no answer. There was no way to do it. And I really felt like all the rest of the people were doing it wrong, and they were just fake or delusional or whatever. And so eventually at some point, I had one night where I'd done something I wasn't planning on doing, and I had a big violent fight with my dad, and I decided that was it. I didn't want to do it anymore, and I just went and collected all the pills I could find and got a glass of wine and took everything and went to bed. And I never told anyone about that until after I got sober. I was serious about it. I was done. I was ready to be done. And I woke up the next day woozy and kind of not walking straight, and so I didn't go to school. And that was just pretty much what the last 6 months were like for me. And during this time, my parents were telling me that if I couldn't get myself together, they were going to send me to a really very serious, very long-term kind of rehab. I forgot until I've been sober years that I had a lot of warning about that, because that's what ended up happening. But but they had talked to me many times and said, we're going to have to do this if you can't stop. And at this point, they were giving me regular breathalyzers, and I was failing them and failing them. And I was drinking in the morning. That was like the one thing I related in about when I got here, that I would get up in the morning and pour myself a glass of Jack Daniels and drink at 7 a.m. getting ready for high school. And then I would bring it with me in a soda bottle. And then I would go into the bathroom and drink on the floor until my boyfriend, who had previously dropped out, would come and pick me up. And that's just what I did every day that last 6 months or so. And so I would, during those conversations with my parents, I would have real moments of feeling like, all right, I got to get this together. I got to stop. And I remember the last one of those conversations, talking to my boyfriend at the time and telling him, this is serious. I'm going to have to try and stop somehow. And knowing that I wasn't going to be able to do it, you know, having one of those moments where I knew there was no way. I couldn't see my life without drinking. It was already too far from a normal life for me to just stop drinking and carry on. That didn't make sense to me at all. And one morning, my parents, or one evening, actually, my parents said, you know, your grandfather is really sick. He's always had a history of depression, and he lived in Florida at the time. And they said, we're going to have to go help him out. He's having a real crisis, and we're going to drive down to Florida and stay with him. And this was a tactic they used to try with me, thinking that if they made an appeal for my help, I would submit, and that didn't work. I was always like, forget it. I'm not coming. Go ahead without me. And that was what happened this time, and they were trying to get me to rehab. And I wouldn't even go on the basis of helping my sick grandfather. And so they had to carry me by my hands and feet. And they had been giving me sedatives for a week prior. I didn't know it at the time. I just thought I was randomly falling asleep standing up all the time. And because they knew they were putting me away, and they didn't know whether I would have withdrawals or anything. They didn't know how much I'd been drinking. And so they had me on these sedatives. And so I woke up, and I said, I'm not going, and they said, yes, you are, and I couldn't figure out why they were so insistent, and they carried me kicking and screaming and biting and put me in the car. And I can still very clearly remember being upside down. You know, my dad had my hands and my mom had my feet, and seeing the neighbor's house and thinking, Jesus, you know, I wonder if these people are watching this, how crazy this looks. And they drove me down to Florida for this rehab because it was the only place they could find that was really long-term and really serious for kids. And I refused to get dressed, so I was in a nightgown, and I was in the back seat, rocking back and forth, banging my head against the windows the whole time. My mom had to sit in the back with me so I wouldn't jump out of the car. And when I was sober for a little while, I thought about that, and I couldn't imagine what that was like for my mother, you know, or my dad. You know, can't imagine what it's like to see your 15-year-old daughter in that condition, and the hopelessness that they felt, and the despair, and all the guilt that they felt, thinking it was their fault that I was the way that I was. So we drove this terrible drive down to Florida, and we showed up at this building, and I walked in, and they said, Lauren, you're not where you think you are. And I had some kind of violent outburst, and eventually, you know, I settled in because I had to. This place was very military-style, intense, a lot of screaming in your face. And I was in there for 17 months, and I was cut off from the entire world during that time. And they were based on the steps, and they did believe in AA, and they did eventually make us go to meetings. In fact, we had to memorize all the steps, so when I got to AA, I had them memorized, and I felt like that gave me some understanding. And I think over time I realized that maybe, you know, it's only through living that I start to comprehend them little by little, you know, a little bit more all the time, and that there seems to be an infinite level of understanding to gain about that. What happened to me is in this rehab, I started to feel alive again. I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. I felt like I was crazy for sure. I definitely believed that. And I did not want to live. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. But being away from it all, I was eating, I was sleeping, and I just started to feel like a human being again. And I hadn't felt that way in a long time, and I'd forgotten those feelings of feeling whole inside. And that was so nice for me that I started to be afraid to get away from it. And when I got out of rehab, I I moved back home, and I went to a young people's meeting. And I was really depressed at that point. I was still sitting in my room moping, and my, you know, my parents were hoping that I was going to be like Little Miss Sunshine when I got home, and I was still really depressed and yelling at people, and I hadn't really learned that much about how to live differently. You know, I was waiting for something to change inside me, but I didn't know that it was about actions that would very slowly change the way I felt inside. And when I read about spiritual parts of the big book, I really was waiting, like, when is God going to just strike me and change me so that I'm a happy, normal person again? And when I read the appendix about a spiritual experience, and it talks about people are often given the impression that we're going to have sudden upheavals that change us, you know, that this is not always the case. This happens for some people, but for most of us, it's a more gradual process that we learn over time. And when I read that, I felt relieved because I felt like something wasn't happening for me that was happening for everyone else, you know. And it always made sense to me when I heard that this was a spiritual disease, because I knew this is the only way I could relate in AA. I felt like I didn't have enough consequences, even though I did have as many consequences as I could have at the time. I'm getting a major shocked face from this. I mean, I guess we all relate out, you know, in any way that we can. But when I heard people talk about this big hole in their gut, I thought, oh my God, I can't believe that people know about this. I've never heard anyone else talk about that. And I had, my parents had sent me to 6 or 7 different shrinks before I got sober. And I lied to all of them, so of course they couldn't help me. And I just wanted them to diagnose me with something that would be treatable with a medication, because I don't know, that seemed like the only possible answer to me at that time, and nobody would do it, and they would ask me about my drinking, and I would get pissed off and insist that that wasn't the problem. And I would try and exaggerate the ink blot tests and say this really crazy stuff, and nobody was fooled. So anyway, I started going to meetings, and I couldn't believe what I found, because there were millions of young people sober, it seemed, and I was really caught off guard by that, and people were happy and having fun. And I remember this woman Debbie picked me up for my first meetings, and she became my sponsor. And there were small things I noticed about people, and she showed up at my house. She just looked really relaxed. And when we drove in the car, she was sitting in a way that I thought, this is a woman who has peace about her. I could feel that. And that's what made me feel attracted and want to stay around a little bit, because these people, obviously something was happening for them, and they were at ease, and they were enjoying life, and they were happy. And if I had come and everybody was just miserable, there's no question I would not have stayed. And so they got me involved in stuff that I did not want to be involved in. You know, it seemed forced into doing things I was not interested in doing, and you know, getting involved in just all the activities that were going on, going to dances. We went to a dance when I was new up in Philadelphia, and I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And I would not dance. It was the only direction. I was terrified of my sponsor then. And I don't know why, but I was. And she told me to dance, and it was the only time I ever said no to her. I was like, forget it. I'm not doing that. I was way too self-conscious back then. So I did this stuff anyway. And I don't know what allowed me to keep doing it, you know. I mean, partly coercion on their part, and then partly just the knowledge that I had nowhere else to go, you know. I could go back to that old life again, but where would I end up? There was nothing else for me to do. And so I kept doing it, and I would get directions to do things that seemed ridiculous to me. And I remember the first time my sponsor told me to set up the meeting or to put the chairs away, I really felt like, why should I have to do that? You know, I'm female, and I'm, you know, whatever I thought. I just felt like I shouldn't have to do that kind of thing. And now it's completely embarrassing to say that I felt that way. But I didn't understand just the harmony that went on in AA at that point. And I didn't grasp what an amazing thing it is that everyone works together to make these things happen. And it functions on its own. You know, nobody is in charge of doing anything, that everybody comes together and does things and it just happens. And so it's, you know, it's a long process. And I started going to those beach weekends I was talking about, and that was uncomfortable at first, you know. Suddenly being surrounded by sober people all the time, I felt very raw, and I felt very exposed, and I was really, really quiet when I got sober. I didn't hardly talk at all for like 2 years. And And but I had to do it anyway, you know, and I would have to speak at meetings and share in meetings. When my sponsor would tell me to share in meetings for my first couple years, I mean, I was going to meetings with 200 people or so at that time. And when she would tell me to share in a meeting, I would have panic attacks, but I would do it anyway. For some reason, something would enable me to do it anyway. And things started to get better. And I did a lot of mentally trying to figure out the first step in that first, you know, year or so out of rehab. And I was really, I felt like I was unsure of whether, because it wasn't entirely my choice to stop drinking, was I going to have to drink again? And I would think about all this stuff. And she would just say, stop thinking about yourself and just go and be a part of the meeting and do something. And eventually that did stop for me. And I eventually came to my own realization that for me, the relationship that I have with alcohol is that it's all or nothing. You know, at times that I thought about drinking, it has never been, let me have a nice glass of wine. It is always, when I think about alcohol, it's all about oblivion. And I know that I can't do that and live a life. And those are my choices, you know, live a spiritual life or go on to that miserable existence that I had before. And so eventually I stopped obsessing about that. And then I was introduced to the God idea, and actually in rehab people had told me to start praying, and I would get into a lot of intellectual banter about it and say, you know, there's nothing there and the world is so dark, if there's a God I don't want to have anything to do with that, and they said, just, it doesn't matter, just say a prayer for the sake of saying a prayer. And I would do it, and eventually I started to feel that when I would take these actions just based on faith, they worked. I felt better, and so I could at least believe in that power. And when my sponsor would tell me to do something and I'd do it, I felt better, and I'd come home feeling happy. And my family would notice it, and they'd say, "Wow, you know, you seem like a different person than when you left for the meeting." And so I believed in that, and you know, I think the idea of a higher power is something that's always continued to grow throughout sobriety, and I've had major encounters with that in this past year, and I guess I'll come back to that. But so I did the fourth and the fifth step, and when I got sober, I didn't really understand character defects at all because I was really quiet, and I felt like quiet people can't be that defective. I mean, I didn't beat people up. I was pretty, like, kind and gentle, I thought, you know, although, you know, having heard my story, you know, that's not entirely the case, but I just didn't get that, and I thought resentment meant you were out there hurting people physically, and it took me a long time to start to realize that, you know, silent scorn, you know, getting pissed off at people and refusing to talk, and then just crying, and then when they ask you what's wrong, you say, oh, nothing, you know, all that stuff, those were character defects, and I started to learn that stuff and see it in sobriety and see myself doing it in sobriety, and gradually I could see that actually realizing I have a part in these things is a huge freedom. It's not about somebody telling me, oh my God, you're such a sick, bad person or whatever. It's really about me recognizing that the way I'm living is not effective. It's not working. I'm running into dead ends all the time. I'm upset with people. Things aren't working out the way I want them to. And that's something I've really gotten a feel for as I've stayed sober, that almost any time I'm disturbed, it's like I want things to be a certain way and it's not working out, and I either get afraid or angry or whatever it is, it's this childishness. And slowly I could start to see that. And when I first read about the self-centeredness in the Big Book, I thought it was so harsh and so not the case. And, you know, gradually I've come to realize what we're talking about there with that. And you know, I did the fifth step and read that whole, my life story, basically, to my sponsor, and there were some things. I didn't find it difficult to really talk about the really big, dramatic stuff. I think as alcoholics, most of us are used to bragging about the big, dramatic stuff. It was like the little, really embarrassing stuff that I didn't want to say that I had to say. And, you know, I did that inventory, and I went to sit and reflect, as the Big Book talks about, and then I came back, and I said, you know what, there's something else. And she said, okay, let's smoke. This seems like something you need to smoke for back then. And it was fine, you know. And it's funny because those same little things that I came out with at the end are things that people I've sponsored have said, okay, there's one more thing. And I've guessed it. I said, is it this? And they're like, oh, my God, yes, it is. And it seems like there's, like, these similar things that none of us want to say, and it's just a relief. And I got into doing amends. You know, before I realized that's what I was doing, my sponsor would have me start taking different actions with my family, because for me, I pretty much just harmed my family. I didn't do a lot of financial damage. I was lucky for that. You know, I caused them a lot of emotional harm. And so they just wanted me to show up as a healthy person and not have to worry about me all the time. And so my sponsor had me start having dinner with them once a week every Friday. And I kept that tradition up forever and ever, it seems. And actually, only in the last year when my sisters moved away have we fallen out of the habit of it. Now we do it every 2 weeks. We all get together. But we did that every Friday for like 8 years straight. And something started to change. You know, I didn't necessarily need to make these scraping admissions and talk about emotionally painful stuff with them. They just wanted me to be there in a new way and listen to them. And eventually I realized I'd never listened to my family. I had no idea what was going on with them, you know, and it was really nice to start to have them come to me with problems. And my father, when I got sober, I couldn't be in the same room with him, because in my rehab, actually, we had an exercise where we had to write down everything we'd ever done wrong, and then we didn't know this was going to be coming next, but then we had to sit down with our families and read them the list. And this is why I think the big book says you need to do this step with a sponsor who is giving you some guidance about what to say, what not to say, because we don't want to disclose things that are going to cause more harm. And I had no idea about that at the time, and I read my dad this list of things, and he's crying and I'm crying, and it's really just a lot more information than he needed to have, and I was more uncomfortable around him after that. And when I came home from rehab, I felt like I didn't know him, and he knew too much about me, and I felt really so uncomfortable. And through, my parents had gotten divorced when I got sober, and so I had one night with my mom and one night with my dad, and I would have dinner with him every week, and that all changed, and we developed a really wonderful relationship, and got to do some traveling together. And when I was about 6 years sober, he passed away very suddenly, and I was so grateful, because a lot of people don't get the opportunity, that I'd had such a wonderful relationship with him, and that we really had been friends, and I'd come to admire him. I mean, you know, when I was 15, kicking and screaming, I had no idea what my parents were. And my dad was someone who was the director of an institution for developmentally disabled people, and I think just, you know, I really, really admired, even before he passed away, and I had this just amazing relationship with him. And on that day, I was on my way to his house to meet him for dinner, and I was going straight to a 5 o'clock meeting that I always went to out near his house, but I'd gotten out of school a little bit early, so I decided to stop there and drop off my things and then go on to the meeting, and he was there and hadn't been feeling well, and so I, you know, it was absolutely the worst night of my entire life. He had a heart attack. But I really believe that somehow circumstances worked out so that I was with him, and I was so grateful for that. And that experience changed me spiritually and made me believe for sure that there's something more than just what I can see on this earth and in my day-to-day experiences. And I forget it so much of the time. And walking through that was definitely hard, and people just carried me. You know, people from AA called and offered to make meals for my family, and would come and pick me up for the meeting and just sit with me and spend time with me. And learning to walk through something hugely emotionally difficult was actually a really amazing thing, to find out what happens when you don't drink every time you have pain, and to find out what an amazing thing it really is. All of that has been, you know, profound experience for me. And it's always hard to transition after that story. But, you know, and going on through the rest of the steps, the 10th and 11th and 12th step, you know, just, it gets more difficult, I think, to maintain my spiritual condition as I'm comfortable. You know, I'm not uncomfortable all the time like I was my first few years. I was uncomfortable my first few years much of the time. That's not true for everyone, but I was. And now I'm pretty much comfortable most of the time. I definitely have off days and I have off moods and all of that stuff, but I'm really, my life is comfortable. I'm pretty much at ease. I enjoy talking to people and meeting people, and that was not the case for so long that I can forget, you know, that I have to maintain my spiritual condition. And little things crop up and happen and remind me and kick me back, you know, and force me to kind of do that. And And this year, my problems now have been really good problems. You know, I'm working 32 hours, and I'm in school full-time, so I'm overwhelmed most of the time. And and occasionally, you know, I have little minor breakdowns about that, but you know, going to meetings every night. And so sometimes it's hard, and for sure. And so it really makes me rely more on meditation and my spiritual condition. And I got to a point in my last semester of school recently where I was just crying like every day, and I haven't been like that in a long time. And I realized it was just this building up sort of breakdown kind of thing, and I was trying to make this huge decision about going on a medical mission to somewhere potentially very dangerous, and people were freaking out in my life about it, and I didn't know what to do. And it wasn't something that should have been a big deal, but because of all the stress, I was just felt like I was going to go crazy. I hadn't felt like that in a long time. I felt like I was going crazy, and I was calling my sponsor a lot and just sobbing, and she would talk me through it. And so the point of this is that I had to make this decision about what to do, and my sponsor wouldn't make it for me. And I felt like, aren't you just going to tell me what to do? And she said, no, I can't make your decisions for you. You have got to get quiet enough to be able to get in touch with your higher power and find out what the right thing is for you. And so this all happened, and one night I was in school, and I had an exam, and it didn't go well, and I just had a total breakdown. I started sobbing, and I couldn't stop. And the school I'm in is very, like, into spiritual things. And so they just said, it's all right, just go sit in this room, and you just sit there and cry as much as you need to. And that's what I did. And I finally, something in me let go, and I felt really quiet and really at peace, and I knew what to do. And I really, that experience isn't hugely profound in its circumstances, but I realized from that the part in the big book, I think we have different periods where different parts seem so important. And the part that talks about deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by, you know, the quote. And then it says, in the final analysis, we found it's only there that he may be found. And that's what that experience did for me. It really made me realize that when I'm overwhelmed or confused or don't know what to do, I can frantically turn to everyone in my life and try and get them to tell me what to do and become more and more hysterical and research more and more. But eventually what I'm going to have to do is just stop and let it all go and let the answer come to me. And really that's an amazing gift. And so I ended up not going on this medical mission. I ended up actually going on a trip to Mexico by myself, which felt like the right thing to do at the time, but felt like a hard thing to tell people, because here I was thinking of considering this very altruistic thing, I ended up doing something very, not actually indulgent, but very very different. And I went on this vacation by myself, and it was completely amazing, and it was exactly what I needed. And I went to meetings there, of course, and I had such a phenomenal, phenomenal time. And that's something I could never have done before, because I couldn't be alone. I couldn't sit in a restaurant and eat by myself back then. And I just went, and I wandered around the town, and I would just lie on the beach all day. And the AA meeting was like a two-mile walk, so I would walk into town. And the English-speaking meeting, I was telling Billy before the meeting, was just a little white brick building, and it said Alcoholics Anonymous painted across the front of the building. Which I was grateful for, because I had no problem finding it. And the funny thing was, people from my home group had recently gone there. So when I went there, I met people, and they said, you know, we had this incredible group of young people come through here recently. And I said, oh, I know all of them. And it was just great. I felt very at home, and I met people that took me sightseeing, and would walk into town every night and go out to dinner with people. And I've had the privilege of getting to travel quite a bit in sobriety. That to me has been one of the coolest things about AA, going different places and meeting people and seeing things. And I went to South Africa once with a girl that I sponsored, and that was just incredible. And we went to meetings there under a tin roof just outside. And they told us the history of AA there, that the first meeting had started because of a homeless man who was digging through a dumpster and found a big book and read the big book and then started a little meeting somehow. And that was their history, and that was really cool. And I went on this trip with my dad before he passed away to Nova Scotia and Newfoundland. And so there's nothing around, you know. And there was one meeting place, and it was like a 2.5-hour drive from where we were staying. And we went down there, and the directions were literally like, there's going to be a white fence, you know, and then you're going to keep driving and there are three rocks, and then you kind of veer to your right and you're going to see a mailbox. It was really crazy. And so eventually I found this meeting. It was like a little shack. And I thought, this can't be it, but it was the only thing on the whole road. And I went in, and it's just full of people. It was like, it didn't seem from the outside that there could have been that many people in this little room. And they were all like middle-aged to older fishermen. And it was just me with all these fishermen. And I had way too much coffee, and they had a bathroom with like a drape or something, not a real door, and I kept having to go to the bathroom during the meeting, and I was completely embarrassed. But it was a great experience, you know, and I everywhere I've gone, I've felt instantly at home with the people. You know, I felt instantly like we absolutely understand each other, regardless of our, you know, circumstances. And when I was in Mexico, I was sharing about that meeting, and someone approached me after the meeting in Mexico and said, I've been to that meeting. I know exactly what you're talking about. And it was just really cool. So it's been a great journey, and I've had a few experiences in this past year with working with people. It's taken me a long time, but finally I've had some experiences where I felt like I had people that I was trying to help that I cared about so much that I felt like I would really do anything. And I hadn't really had that feeling before, and I don't know what changed, but it's been an amazing experience to finally understand what it is to really want to see this happen for someone else who you know desperately needs it. And sometimes it is heartbreaking. You know, I've seen people not do well, and I've seen people do well, and it really is an interesting life that I wouldn't want to trade. And it's always so great to come speak at these things because it reminds me, you know, I can absolutely complain about my schedule and my life and all this stuff, and it reminds me of how much I'd rather have this than just your typical everyday life. So thank you very much, and I'm done.